excitements of the car crash after my first meeting with Vaughn. Propelled on a pair of scarred and uneven legs, repeatedly injured in one or other vehicle collision, the harsh and unsettling figure of this hoodlum scientist came into my life at a time when his obsessions were self-evidently those of a madman. As I drove home from the film studios at Shepperton on a rain-swept June evening, my car skidded at the intersection below the entrance to the Western Avenue flyover. Within seconds, I was moving at 60 miles an hour into the oncoming lane. As the car struck the central reservation, the offside tire blew out and whirled off its rim. Out of my control, the car crossed the reservation and turned up the high-speed exit ramp. Three vehicles were approaching, mass-produced saloon cars whose exact model year, color schemes, and external accessories I can still remember with the painful accuracy of a never-to-be-eluded nightmare. The first two I missed, pumping the brakes and barely managing to steer my car between them. The third, carrying a young woman doctor and her husband, I struck head-on. The man, a chemical engineer with an American foodstuffs company, was killed instantly, propelled through his windshield like a mattress from the barrel of a circus cannon. He died on the bonnet of my car, his blood sprayed through the fractured windshield across my face and chest. The fireman, who later cut me from the crushed cabin of my car, assumed that I was bleeding to death from a massive open-heart wound. I was barely injured. On my way home, after leaving my secretary, Renata, who was freeing herself from an unsettling affair with me, I was still wearing the safety belt I had deliberately fastened to save her from the embarrassment of embracing me. My chest was severely bruised against the steering wheel, my knees crushed into the instrument panel as my body moved forwards into its own collision with the interior of the car. But my only serious injury was a severed nerve in my scalp. The same mysterious forces that saved me from being impaled on the steering wheel also saved the young engineer's wife. Apart from a bruised upper jawbone and several loosened teeth, she was unharmed. During my first hours at Ashford Hospital, all I could see in my mind was the image of us locked together, face to face in these two cars, the body of her dying husband lying between us on the bonnet of my car. We looked at each other through the fractured windshields, neither able to move. Her husband's hand, no more than a few inches from me, lay palm upwards beside the right windshield wiper. His hand had struck some rigid object as he was hurled from his seat, and the pattern of a sign formed itself as I sat there, pumped up by his dying circulation into a huge blood blister, the Triton signature of my radiator. Supported by her diagonal seatbelt, his wife sat behind her steering wheel, staring at me in a curiously formal way, as if unsure what had brought us together. Her handsome face, topped by a broad, intelligent forehead, had the blank and unresponsive look of a Madonna in an early Renaissance icon. Unwilling to accept the miracle or nightmare sprung from her loins, only once did any emotion cross it, when she seemed to see me clearly for the first time, and a peculiar rictus twisted the right side of her face, as if the nerve had been pulled on a string. Did she realize then that the blood covering my face and chest was her husband's? Our two cars were surrounded by a circle of spectators, their silent faces watching us with enormous seriousness. After this brief pause, everything broke into manic activity. tires singing, half a dozen cars pulled onto the verge and mounted the central reservation. A massive traffic jam formed along Western Avenue. Sirens wailed as police headlamps flared against the rear bumpers of stalled vehicles tailing back along the flyover. An elderly man in a transparent plastic raincoat was pulling uneasily at the passenger door behind my head as if frightened that the car might throw a powerful electric charge into his thin hand. A young woman carrying a tartan blanket lowered her head to the window. Only a few inches away, she stared at me with pursed lips like a mourner peering down at a corpse laid out in an open coffin. Unaware of any pain at that time, I sat with my right hand holding a spoke of the steering wheel. Still wearing her seatbelt, the dead man's wife was coming to her senses. A small group of people, a truck driver, an off-duty soldier in uniform, and a woman ice cream attendant, were pressing their hands at her through the windows, apparently touching parts of her body. She beckoned them away and freed the harness across her chest, her capable hand fumbling with the chromium release mechanism. For a moment, I felt that we were the principal actors at the climax of some grim drama in an unrehearsed theater of technology, involving these crushed machines, the dead man destroyed in their collision, and the hundreds of drivers waiting beside the stage with their headlamps blazing. The young woman was helped from her car. Her awkward legs and the angular movements of her head appeared to mimic the distorted streamlining of the two cars. The rectangular bonnet of my car had been wrenched off its seating below the windshield, and the narrow angle between the bonnet and fenders seemed to my exhausted mind to be repeated in everything around me. The expressions and postures of the spectators, the ascending ramp of the flyover, the flight paths of the airliners lifting from distant airways, runways of the airport. The young woman was carefully steered from her car by an olive-skinned man in the midnight blue uniform of an Arab airline pilot. A thin stream of urine trickled involuntarily between her legs, running down onto the roadway. The pilot held her shoulders reassuringly. Standing beside their cars, the spectators watched this puddle forming on the oil-stained macadam. In the fading evening light, rainbows began to circle her weak ankles. She turned and stared down at me, a peculiar grimace on her bruised face, a clear confusion of concern and hostility. However, all I could see was the unusual juncture of her thighs opened towards me in this deformed way. It was not the sexuality of the posture that stayed in my mind, but the stylization of the terrible events that had involved us, the extremes of pain and violence ritualized in this gesture of her legs, like the exaggerated pirouette of a mentally defective girl I had once seen performing in a Christmas play at an institution. I gripped the steering wheel in both hands, trying to keep still. A continuous tremor shook my chest and almost stopped me from breathing. A policeman's strong hands held my shoulder. A second policeman placed his flat-beaked cap on the bonnet of the car beside the dead man and began to wrench at the door. The frontal impact had compressed the forward section of the passenger compartment, jamming the doors onto their locks. An ambulance attendant reached across me and cut the sleeve from my right arm. A young man in a dark suit drew my hand through the window. As the hypodermic needle slid into my arm, I wondered if this doctor, who seemed no more than an overlarge child, was old enough to have qualified professionally. An uneasy euphoria carried me towards the hospital. I vomited across the steering wheel, half conscious of a series of unpleasant fantasies. Two firemen cut the door from its hinges. Dropping it onto the road, they peered down at me like the assistants of a gored bullfighter. Even their smallest movements seem to be formalized, hands reaching towards me in a series of coded gestures. If one of them had unbuttoned his coarse serge trousers to reveal his genitalia and pressed his penis into the bloody crotch of my armpit, even this bizarre act would have been acceptable in terms of the stylization of violence and rescue. I waited for someone to reassure me as I sat there, dressed in another man's blood, while the urine of his young widow formed rainbows around my rescuer's feet. By the same nightmare logic, the firemen racing toward the burning wrecks of crashed airliners might trace obscene or humorous slogans on the scalding concrete with their carbon dioxide sprays. Executioners could dress their victims in grotesque costumes. In return, the victims would stylize the entrances to their deaths with ironic gestures, solemnly kissing their executioners' gun butts, desecrating imaginary flags. Surgeons would cut themselves carelessly before making their first incisions. Wives casually murmur the names of their lovers at the moment of their husband's orgasms. The whore mouthing her customer's penis might, without offense, bite a small circle of tissue from the upper curvature of his glands. That same painful bite which I once received from a tired prostitute, irritated by my hesitant erection, reminds me of the stylized gestures of ambulance attendants and filling station personnel, each with their repertory of private movements. Later, I learned that Vaughn collected the grimaces of casualty nurses in his photographic albums. Their dark skins mediated all the sly sexuality which Vaughn aroused in them. Their patients died in the interval between one rubber-soled step and the next, when the shifting contours of their thighs as they touched each other died in the doors of emergency. The policemen lifted me from the car, their firm hands steering me onto the stretcher. Already I felt isolated. The policemen lit this accident. I tried to sit up on the stretcher and swung my legs from the blanket. The young doctor pushed me back, hitting my chest with the palm of his hand, surprised by the irritation in his eyes. I lay back passively. The draped body of the dead man was lifted from the bonnet of my car. Seated like a demented Madonna between the doors of the second ambulance, his wife gazed vacantly at the evening traffic. The wound in her right cheek was slowly deforming her face as the bruised tissues gorged themselves on their own blood. Already I was aware that the interlocked radiator grills of our cars formed the model of an inescapable and perverse union between us. I stared at the contours of my thighs. Across them, the gray blanket formed a graceful dune. Somewhere beneath this mound lay the treasure of your pubis, its precise jut and rake, the untouched sexuality of this intelligent woman presided over its tragic events of the evening. Presided over its precise events of the evening.
stuck with me. Rainbow never has a burn. No gold, no matter what. Will you choose to lose? Will you choose to lose? Take the easy way. Unravel the endless knot. Take the easy way. Unravel the endless knot. Unravel the endless knot. Take the easy way. Unravel the endless knot. Unravel the endless knot.
Did I ever tell you that this is my kid? Had 23 sons and she named them all Dave. Well, she did, and there wasn't a smart thing to do. You see, when she wants one and calls out Yoo-hoo, come into the house, Dave, she doesn't get one. 23 babes of hers come on the run. This makes things quite difficult at the McCabe's. As you can imagine, with so many babes, and often she wishes that when they were born, she had named one of them Bodkin Van Horn. One of them who's Spooz, and one of them Snim, and one of them Hotshot, and one Sonny Jim, and one of them Shadrack, and one of them Blinky, and one of them Stuffy, and another one Stinky. Marvin, who gravel balloon face, and one of them Ziggy, and one Soggy Muff, one Buffalo Bill, and one Buffalo Buff, one of them Sneepy, and one Weepy Wee, and one Paris Garters, and one Harris Tweed, and one of them Sir Michael Carmichael Zut, one of them Oliver Bolivar Butt, and one of them Zanzibar Buck Buck McFeet. But she didn't do it, and now it's too late.
Beautiful noise. On the Chill Room on this Saturday night. Live for just your ears, Dave, I think. I don't know if anybody else is out there. Louise was there, but I think she fell asleep. Oh, there she is. Hi, Louise. We started off with Stormy Monday Blues by the McCoys from Him and Ball. And then the Versatile Newts did Nutrition. And the Carpenters, haha. We've only just begun. Glenn Branca, Devil Choirs at the Gates of Heaven. The McCoys, Union City Waltz from Infinite McCoys. Don Ellis, Live at Monterey. 3-3-2-2-2-1-2-2-2. Van Dyke Parks from Discover America, Sailing Shoes. Patti Smith from her covers album, White Rabbit. From a radio broadcast of Hitchcock's The Babysitter with Thelma Ritter, we heard Hello, Mr. Nash. And Dangerous Girls did Dangerous Girls. Jason Forrest from the Monk's tribute album did Monk Hop. And we heard two versions of Looking at You by the MC5. First the A Squared version from 1966, and then the album Atlantic version from 1969. I love that song. I love everything. Everything I played. And we heard Crash Chapter 2 by J.G. Ballard, read by me as best as I could. And Return to Sender by B. Queen, and Throbbing Gristle's Greasy Spoon was over that. And Throbbing Gristle did The Endless Knot. And Dylan Here's a Who did Too Many Daves. Vic Thrills and the Saturn Missile did Nothing Left to Defend. The McCoys did Epilogue. And It's Close to You. What you heard tonight was what I do when I have less equipment. I was unable to sustain tones because I was missing one player. So you heard a simpler Chill Room. This is Kill Radio in Los Angeles. It's 2:36 a.m. Thanks for listening tonight. No one called. But the benefit will go on. So stay tuned.